Out With by Bedwyr Williams, performed by Hilary Lyon. I'm assuming that you're listening to this at the Collective. Let's begin at the large gates outside. Walk forward diagonally over the hard standing towards a green bollard and litter bin. Follow the path that leads down the hill and turn left at the bottom. Turn left and follow the path along until you reach the first bench, marked Remembering with Love and Pride, Alberto Cuesta Pastor. There you go. Now then, take a seat and relax. I'd like you to do something for me if you could. Just cast your gaze down onto the building in front of you, the one with a lawn on the roof. It's a hotel, a very nice hotel. The grass is a bit of a folly, really. It surely can't grow up there forever. Inevitably, there'll be a time when it's dug up and thrown down construction chutes into a skip on the street below. But for now, it'll serve our purpose just fine. There are some very beautiful gardens on roofs around the world, and I have sat in a fair few of them. As a younger woman, I once spent an afternoon in a truly magical roof garden in Tokyo. It was like a miniature rainforest high above the streets. Using a kind of improvised sign language and some cashew nuts, the owner explained to me that it was grown slowly from seeds pooped out by visiting birds, and over the years it had matured without any intervention from him. He was exaggerating and lying, of course, since some of the seeds of the larger trees were too big to have ever entered or exited a bird. But it was a nice story, well told. I heard some time later that he died of a stroke in that garden, and that because of the narrow stairway, his body had to be lowered in the window cleaner's gondola. Adjust yourself as if you were a mortar being aimed. Tilt your torso so that your spine traces the beginning of an arc trained on the centre of the hotel lawn. Take a deep breath, hold it, and visualise that dotted trajectory in front of you. The next part's a wee bit tricky, but I'm sure you'll be fine. Block your nostrils with your thumbs and insert both index fingers in your ears. You'll need to twist your hands a bit, as if you were gripping a bowling ball with only two holes. Now blow steadily, as hard as you can, all the time keeping your eyes shut tight. That's very important. After a few seconds, it will feel as if you have an upside-down headache and your crown should flip open, cleanly sending your brain looping up into the air. This will take 5 seconds and is quite painless. Your brain lands on the grass. If the grass has been freshly mown, tiny cuttings will cling to it as it rolls to a stop. It's very unlikely your brain will be seen by staff or guests. Try to think of it like a stray ball landing in a garden. To anybody glancing over at it, that's what it'll look like. You'll be quite safe. With the wee nub of spinal cord that's still attached, dibble yourself a hole into the grass and relax. You should feel a bit dreamy at this point. dreamy, but in control dreamy. Obviously, you won't be able to see this, but your body and open head are still on the bench on Carlton Hill, with your fingers still in your nose and ears. But don't worry, it's okay. A member of the collective will attend to it the whole time with a blanket, just in case. Some people get a wee bit shivery at this point, but nothing more than that, really. You're plugged in, and that's great. I've arranged it so that you can experience some of the guests that have stayed here. The best rooms of the hotel surround the lawn on three sides. Why don't we start at the one on the far right, where we find two sisters sharing a spacious, well-lit suite. One is a writer on industrial history. The other, the big sister, is a completely imaginary person, a kind of spectre. They're both very striking in their appearance, with pale, long faces and unruly salt-and-pepper hair. Big Sister is an apparition that snores and coughs and moves like her sibling, but is not an actual person. She's very similar to her sister, rather than the same, in that she's physically larger. She's not masculine in any way, just bigger and more powerful. She is stronger in every sense, her muscles, her smell, and her voice. She is also mentally stronger. When she means to make mischief, she swipes at her sister's temples with slip-on shoes or pumps, practical, oversized flats, which produce quite a snap in the hotel room when they connect. Every half hour or so, she opens the door and shouts lewd comments into the empty corridor with her ever so slightly larger mouth. It is a female voice that she has, but with more gain, almost like a tenor yelling, if you can imagine that. The larger ghost sister sits on her sibling's legs, pressing down until the smaller real sister gets pins and needles as she tries to rest on the bed. The big sister does this for hours. After a while, big sis lifts up a little and twists round to open the door of the minibar behind her with her extra long arms. She composes songs using the names of the different bottles and cans for inspiration. The bells, sister, the bells. I gotta tell you about the bells. Gordon's gonna tell you about the bells. An appetizer will hypnotize her. And KP, well, KP is gonna keep stum. Oh, yeah. KP is going to keep shtum de dum dum de dum. Dry roasted!
You are driving me crazy with your nonsense! The little sister screams. You're ruining everything! She adds.
And what about the little baby half-can Carlsberg baby?
Little sister decides to put an end to all this. She summons all her strength and moves into a crab position, which is something she hasn't done for years and years. Big sister tumbles off and smashes through a kind of slatted room divider at the foot of the bed and thuds onto the floor. When the younger, smaller, realer sister gets up to look, however, big sister is nowhere to be seen. There's just a small bottle of Britvic on its side. She is alone at last. She picks up the bottle of Britvic. In her handbag, there's a bottle opener the shape of a tennis racket, which she's had for years since some Christmas party or other. She opens the bottle and drinks it slowly until it's all gone.
It's a strange flavour, she thinks. Different to all other orange drinks. It's unique.
Strong. She leaves the Do Not Disturb sign on the door for the rest of the day. After picking up some supplies from Murray's tool store, she sets about repairing the screen. It takes her almost 4 hours, plus a couple more for the paint to dry. But she succeeds. To hide the sound of her banging and working, she coughs loudly.
Ahem.
The absurdity of the situation makes her laugh. And after a while, she decides to hide the sound of her working with laughter. If you were to enter that room now, you would have to be very eagle-eyed to spot the repair at all. Let's skip the next room to the left. Not much has ever happened there, although some years ago the cleaners found that somebody had stuck a large sticker of a dog, a Labrador, on the bathroom mirror. One of those really sticky stickers that need to be scraped off. Now, let's move to the next room along. It gets exactly the same light as the last room, but somehow seems a little darker. It smells differently too, like marzipan or some kind of cakey-bakey smell. There is a tallish gentleman in this room. He has the look of a teacher or lecturer, but he's left that life behind. He's now a small businessman who makes geodesic domes for people to use as greenhouses. He's in Edinburgh on business, and his Gladstone bag is full of brochures and pamphlets relating to his products, which range from large domes for universities right down to wee domes for domestic use. The brochures look rather unprofessional, and the registration of the print is a little off. There's a photo of him on the back with the statement, "I want to make domes available to everybody." He's getting ready for bed, brushing his teeth in the ensuite. He wears a denture from when, as a young man, he crashed into a skip that had no lights on it. He cleans the denture and places it to soak in a tumbler, which he places on his bedside table. This is the fifth denture he has owned since the accident. When he flips open his suitcase, it's clear that this is where the marzipan smell is coming from. It's the smell of his home, and doubtless his children's sports kits and homework smell of it too. It's nice, but it can be overwhelming. While he is undressing, he questions himself about domes. I mean, he actually talks to himself in the hotel room. He's in his underpants, looking at his reflection in the window, talking to himself. The thing about a geodesic dome is that eventually it will be destroyed, he says. Building it is stressful and difficult, and all that bloody stress is stored up in the dome until the day it is dismantled or destroyed. He tries to shoo off some of his negative train of thought by letting out a huge sigh and gets into bed. He's reading a book called Onward: How Starbucks Fought for Its Life Without Losing Its Soul. Later, when he puts his Kindle to one side, he looks at his denture in the glass. He thinks how, from this low angle and with his head on one side, it looks exactly like a scythe. And just as he's about to turn off the light, a bubble forms and slowly escapes from a gap between two teeth. It floats to the surface and pops. He winces as if he can actually feel it himself. Now, if we hop another two rooms along, we will find a glamour model. She's very pretty, but she's cross. I always feel especially uncomfortable when attractive people are angry. She has dropped talc into her open suitcase. The talc was in a cardboard egg that had come apart in her hands and showered her belongings in a single whoomph. Her suede boots are ruined, and the grapes she had bought that morning are also coated. They look nice. She arranges them on the dressing table, but they're completely inedible now. She photographs the mess in her suitcase with her mobile phone and tweets it with the caption, "No point crying over spilt talc." Within moments, she gets notifications that her tweet has been favourited and retweeted by half a dozen of her male fans. This makes her feel depressed, and she throws the phone onto the puffed-up duvet. Tomorrow morning, she will be doing the shoot in the room and the roof garden not far from your brain. It seemed sensible, if the shoot was to take place there, that she stayed there too. It's the first time she's done this, sleeping at the location. She pictures the stylist and the photographer arriving the next morning to prepare and photograph her. She's worried that her sleep smell will hit them when they enter the room. She suddenly feels trapped and, as a quick fix, walks over to the window, opens it and looks up towards Calton Hill. She picks up the talc-y grapes and throws them underarm onto the lawn. The talc is immediately carried off by the wind, and in a few moments' time, a street away, a scaffolder smells bergamot on the breeze and mistakes it for the deodorant of a co-worker. The grapes disappear in the long grass. One bounces off your brain, but you can't feel it, although you sense it. The model has an iPad on her bedside table. It was a gift from her agent. She uses it for all the usual things, but her real delight lies in looking at the photo app where she has distorted her agent's face and the faces of stylists and hairdressers. Everybody does it, but the model experiences an extra level of pleasure. She likes seeing the photographer's face cinched like a twisted wick and her agent's eyes shrunken and sunken. If only it was a voodoo app that could really do these things to them, she thinks as the battery runs out. Another occupant of the hotel, whose thoughts have been torturing him for days, breaks down. He thinks about a woodwork teacher he once had who could hit a nail flush with a single blow of a claw hammer. That's what nailing it means. He thinks about doing it in one, about doing things in one. He lies down and coils his legs around one pair of chair legs and his arms around the other pair. He wriggles into position and then, by tensing his body, but with very little movement, all four chair legs crack and snap. He has destroyed the chair in one. And the white canvas, which was taut a few seconds before, slackens off and shows its staples. He Fosbury flops onto the desk, smacking it down onto the floor with one almighty bang, which actually sounds more like a quack than a bang. All four legs splay, and the desktop is split in two. There's a beat playing over the digital radio, which he wasn't following before, but he syncs up with it now. He yanks the curtain off the shower in one, and the rings ping off, quick as a flash. He kicks a quick double-splits jump and takes out both bedside lights in one, landing on the bed. If you enter the next room, you become aware of a young man, a florist's assistant, dressing a room for a fussy guest with a bouquet and some petals on the bed. The smell of floristry is one of my absolute favourites, and it's on this young man, on his clothes. While filling the vase, he drops it into the unusual glass sink, which cracks, leaking water all over the carpet. It wasn't much of an impact, but enough, obviously. The florist's lad looks at the water pouring out of the broken sink, still holding the stems. The scale of the damage and the fact that he only has flowers to hand makes him feel sick and anxious. There's nothing he can do. He decides to fake an assault. He tries to punch himself in the face, but he can't do it hard enough, so he puts his shoe in a plastic bag and swings that up towards his face. It works. He does it one more time and the bag bursts. He puts his shoe back on and lies down next to the WC and pretends to be unconscious. He lies there for 2.5 hours, but nobody comes. Two rooms along, a man who has just taken part in a marathon sits on the bed in his foil cape, twiddling his medal and twitching one calf muscle, then the other. He's thinking that he should have booked into a cheaper hotel. He has very prominent eyebrows, which are also quite high up on his face. When he runs, he has the appearance of a frightened man running from danger. It's a running joke since his college days. His wife and son are on the grass outside. The little boy is running around in circles while the mother stares into space. The wind is gusting in such a way that hair is blown into her face no matter which way she turns. The son notices something on the grass and picks it up. "What have you got there, darling?" his mother calls. "Nothing," he replies. She walks over and screams.
Oh, 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 oh,
The marathon man, obviously still tired, jogs over on his hairy legs, which seems somehow out of place in the hotel garden.
Look! It's a fucking brain!
Gavin nudges your brain with his Asics running shoes. He has them tied quite tight, which they say you shouldn't do. He nudges it again, rolling it over as if it were a hedgehog or something. The underside of your brain is damp from the grass. It has a slightly nutty aroma, which upsets the wife and makes her cry. The duty manager of the hotel has heard the commotion and walks over, leaving behind the fire extinguisher technician he had been showing around the hotel. The fire extinguisher man has an enormous beard and reactor-like glasses, which have just reacted to the light outside. The manager makes a phone call and then escorts the family back to their room. The mother is very upset, but the child hasn't really understood what has happened. The manager stays with them for some time. The man with the beard and sunglasses walks towards your brain. He puts down his tool bag and crouches over it. He looks around before picking it up with both hands. He opens his mouth and takes a huge bite, a big chomp. His face is in your brain and he's chewing. He looks up again to see if he's being watched, his beard damp with your grey matter, all the while chewing and swallowing. He takes another bite and the brain is now in two parts. By the time the manager gets back, it's all gone. And so is Fire Extinguisher Man.